Lucid Dreaming. In a moment, we'll be talking with David J. Brown, Dreaming Wide Awake, Lucid Dreaming, Shamanic Healing, and Psychedelics. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about our next guest. David J. Brown holds a master's degree in psychobiology from the New York University, responsible for the California-based research in two of the British biologist Rupert Sheldrake's books, one of our past guests on unexplained phenomena in science, dogs that know when their owners are coming home and the sense of being stared at. Two great subjects. Brown science articles, numerous interviews have appeared in many magazines, including Wired, Discover, Scientific American, and he was a senior editor of the bulletins of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies from 2007 to 12. David, welcome to the program. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
Thank you, George. It's a real pleasure to be here. Let me just say, I've listened to your show for years, and I've really enjoyed it, so it's a real pleasure to actually be talking
Thank
to you.
We're going to have a great time. Psychobiology, what the heck is that?
Psychobiology is a term that's not really used that much anymore. It's the interface between psychology and biology. It's now called physiological psychology or behavioral neuroscience or sociobiology, but it basically covers the area where psychology and biology interlap. So it looks at how the brain affects behavior, how behaviors evolve, and how neurochemistry affects psychology, and all the interfaces between psychology and biology.
We're going to talk a lot about lucid dreaming, but your research for Rupert Sheldrake, absolutely incredible, because I've had dogs all my life, and they do know when you're coming home. And then you had that other feeling, that other work you did, the sense of being stared at. Both amazing phenomena.
Yes, they truly are. Isn't it interesting that people haven't really studied this scientifically before?
No.
People have been reporting this for hundreds of years, and it's so interesting that, you know, in the laboratory people have studied animals so carefully, and in the wild they've been studied so carefully, but the really unique bond between humans and their pets has never really been carefully studied before, and I think that's really one of the great marks of genius that Rupert Sheldrake had.
I used to, when I was in school, I grew, mid-school, concentrate on the back heads of people when I was sitting in the school class to see if they would turn around. And they would about 60% of the time. It was really strange.
Yeah, it's really amazing. We did a number of studies. The average person will do better than chance at being able to tell if someone's staring at them. And there are some people that are remarkably good at it. Some people, you know, score like 80% on it. So some people, you know, it's a talent that varies from person to person, but it seems like everybody has some semblance of it.
And what is it they're feeling in order to get that feeling that someone's staring at them?
You know, it's kind of an people report a kind of undefined kind of tingling on the back of their neck, or just a, you know, just a psychological feeling. You know, somebody's looking at me. I just have this weird feeling, and oftentimes people are right. It's really uncanny. Rupert Sheldrake believes that, you know, that if this ability is real, then certainly evolution would have capitalized on it, and people would have evolved, animals would have evolved in order to be able to utilize it.
And tell me about your work in the psychedelic studies that you did in 2007.
Well, what I did for 2007 to 2012 was I was the senior editor for the MAPS Bulletin, and MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, is a organization that funds research into the use of psychedelic drugs like LSD, psilocybin, MDMA, to look for their medical benefits. Right now, PTSD is being studied with MDMA with really remarkable results. They're looking at psilocybin, the active component in magic mushrooms, as a treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder, for end-of-life anxiety, and there are a multitude of other treatments going on. There's really kind of a renaissance right now going on with psychedelic drug research, and the work that I did is basically as a science writer. I wrote an article for Scientific American, a lead story about that years ago, and then I, for the next 5 years, I edited the MAPS bulletins and put together different theme issues for MAPS. There was one about psychology, psychedelics and technology, one about psychedelics and the arts, one about psychedelics and death and dying, one about psychedelics and the mind and the body. So all these different areas that psychedelics have had an influence on. I recruited writers from all over the world, and we put together some pretty unique bulletins. If anyone's interested, the bulletins are still online on maps.com. They're all archived for those years.
Have you come to some conclusion, David, on what all this is? You've studied dreams, lucid dreaming, shamanic healing, all these things that are there, the staring, the animals sensing things. What do you think people and animals, what are we tapping into?
Well, I think that there are circuits of the brain that haven't really been utilized. I think that for most of human evolution, we've been in survival mode, basically. You know, we've been primarily concerned with those aspects that have to do with, you know, eating, sleeping, protecting ourselves, reproducing, and making sure some of our genes get into the next generation. And for many, 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 many thousands, millions of years, this has been going on in animals and in us. And I think that once the survival aspects of our biology are satisfied, there are circuits of the brain that start to emerge, and these are what's, you know, has been appearing sporadically throughout the past couple thousand years, and yogis who meditate, and artists who reach creative states, people who have out of body experiences, people who are tapping into psychic phenomena, people who are being able to access lucid dreaming, psychedelic states of consciousness. All these different things seem to be pointing to the fact that the brain has far more potential than we normally thought, and we're just now learning how to utilize these different brain circuits. And our scientific research now is, I'm sure, going to help us to be able to utilize them even further. So I'm very hopeful and really wonder about where this is all going to be going over the next couple of years. It truly excites me.
David, dreams are all kinds of dreams. Of course, we have the ordinary kind of dreams. We have precognitive dreams. We have nightmares, lucid dreaming. How did you key in on lucid dreaming, and give us your definition of what that is?
Okay, well, I started lucid dreaming spontaneously when I was around 16 years old. I experimented with psychedelics when I was a teenager, and about 2 days after that experience, I had my first lucid dream where I became awake and aware in the dream. It wasn't long after that I met Stephen LaBerge, who is a lucid dream researcher, and I interviewed him for my book, Mavericks of the Mind, and that was what really got me into learning the techniques and developing it and cultivating this over the years. A lucid dream, for your listeners who don't know, is when you become awake and aware in a dream while it is actually happening. In other words, it would be like right now, realizing that the world around you is a dream. I mean, look around you for a second and just imagine that you're in a dream. It really looks this real, and it really is extraordinary. In an ordinary dream, what happens is we confuse the dream environment for the waking world. And in a lucid dream, we become aware. We have the insight that our bodies are lying peacefully asleep, soundly in bed, you know, in some other reality, and that the world around us is a complete projection of our minds, that we're actually living in our imagination or in some kind of mental construct. And it is absolutely extraordinary. For people who haven't experienced it, it is just absolutely amazing to wake up inside of a dream and look around you and to see the detail and the way the colors are so bright and the, you know, how just the incredible magnificence of a dream, because you know that it's being entirely created in your mind. And then with this insight comes the liberation to be able to explore, you know, create and experiment in this realm. You can do all kinds of extraordinary things because there are no social or biological consequences to deal with like we have to in this reality.
Is there much science behind any of this, David, yet?
Oh, there is actually quite a bit of science. You know, I mean, it's mentioned in religious scriptures for thousands of years, and the first systematic study of lucid dreaming really began in 1867 with a French scholar by the name of Marquis de Hervé de Saint-Denis, and he wrote a famous book called Dreams and How to Guide Them. And what he had done was basically keep a dream diary for years, where he was having many lucid dreams, and he would experiment in them and see what was possible and what wasn't possible. And that was really the very first documentation. The first mention of lucid dreaming in the Western scientific literature was in 1913 by psychiatrist Frederick von Eden, and he was a contemporary of Sigmund Freud's. Sigmund Freud, believe it or not, actually was aware of lucid dreaming. He mentions it in his famous book, Interpretation of Dreams. It's just a footnote in the book, unfortunately. It seems like he's never had any experience with it and wasn't aware of its therapeutic potential. But the first real research occurred in the mid-1970s. There was a lot of debate among psychologists over the years about whether lucid dreaming was even real or not. People who had experienced it, you know, claimed that they were as awake and aware in their dreams as they were when they were awake during the day. And critics, you know, and many psychologists who hadn't experienced it themselves, you know, were saying that, oh, you know, you're just dreaming that you're awake. You're not really awake. And so they, what happened was in the mid-1970s, a British researcher by the name of Keith Hearn conducted a remarkable experiment. What he did was he recruited someone who was a proficient lucid dreamer and had had him go to sleep in his sleep laboratory. And what he did was, well, first let me just say that when you go to sleep at night and you're dreaming, your body's in a state of paralysis. And this is so that you don't act out the behaviors in your dreams. Otherwise, you'd
you could have a problem. But some people do that. They walk.
And there are some people, you're right, medically, there are some people, and they have to sleep in rooms with, you know, just padded walls and no sharp corners. So it's a good thing that we go into this state of paralysis when we're asleep.
We have to start strapping our bodies down.
Right. So, but the thing is, though, is that our entire bodies aren't in a state of paralysis. We can actually move our eyes, and our breathing rate is the same in a dream as it is in our physical bodies.
Okay.
So what Keith Hearn did was he instructed his lucid dreamer to signal from the dream state by moving his eyes in a specific pattern, almost like a Morse code signal, you know, two to the right, two to the left, two to the right. So he was able to show that the person, you know, through they had, you know, an EEG monitor, something monitoring the person's brain waves, able to show that they were in a state of sleep, and then while they were in a state of sleep, they were suddenly, you can see when they were measuring the eye movements, there were these sweeping movements, you know, across the paper, all the way to the right, all the way to the left, all the way to the right, clear signals that the person in the dream state, while they were asleep, was able to consciously signal to the outside world. That was the first research that showed that lucid dreaming was indeed a real phenomenon that could be scientifically verified. That was again replicated by Stephen LaBerge at Stanford University a couple years later, who was actually unaware of Keith Hearn's work and did this independently using himself as a subject. So that was how lucid dreaming got established as a science. Then, years later, at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, they discovered that physiologically what is actually happening inside the brain, we now know that when people are lucid dreaming, there's an area in the left hemisphere of the brain in the very front called the prefrontal cortex. And that area of the brain is normally dormant and inactive when we're asleep and dreaming. And people who are lucid dreaming, that area is wildly active, and so active it's actually vibrating with gamma waves, which are the very fastest brain waves known. And what's even more remarkable is the latest research in lucid dreaming shows that when we administer something called transcranial brain stimulation, this is electrical brain stimulation applied through the scalp, and they can apply it directly through the scalp so that it stimulates specific brain regions. When you use transcranial electrical brain stimulation to stimulate the prefrontal cortex in people who are in REM sleep, about 80% of those people have lucid dreams. So we now have developed a technology that allows people to lucid dream on command.
Wow.
And in fact, there is now a Kickstarter program. Somebody's looking to actually make these devices available to the population.
What can you do in a lucid dream? I mean, do you wander around in it going, oh, I know this is a dream, or do you actually change the outcome?
Well, it's not that you have control over the dream, but more that you can influence it. First of all, let me say, if you find yourself in a lucid dream tonight, the first thing to do is to stay calm. Because if you get too excited, if your emotions get too aroused, you'll find yourself physically waking up out of the dream state and back into your...
And it is weird being in that state for a while, if you're not used to it.
Oh, it is definitely unusual. It is like an altered state of consciousness. And when you're in it, I mean, you can fly, swim underwater, you can have sex with your ideal lover, you can make anything appear out of thin air, you can zoom through outer space, move things with your mind. I mean, really, it's unlimited in terms of fantasy fulfillment and all the kind of things you can do.
And it seems real.
it seems as real as the waking world. It really does. I've been in lucid dreams, and I sit there, and I will pick up an object and look at it and try to see what is the difference between how this looks in a dream and how it looks in physical reality, and I cannot differentiate.
I sometimes wonder, David, if what we're doing now is the dream.
Well, see, now you're really getting into the philosophical implications of lucid dreaming because, you know, physical reality and the reality you're in when you're in a lucid dream are both models created in your mind. And when you really contemplate that and really think about that, it makes you really wonder just how real physical reality is. When you see how well it can be replicated in your mind through memory and imagination, you really wonder how real this real world really is.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. So once you're in this dream, this lucid dream, and you don't panic, calm down, what do you do next?
Okay, so after you've satisfied your, you know, all your desires for fantasy fulfillment and sexual fulfillment and all those crazy things, the next thing you can really try doing in a lucid dream is performance enhancement. You can practice a particular skill that you would like to improve, you know, tennis, public speaking, martial arts, if you're, you know, into hula hooping, you know, any type of sport or activity or whatever you're into will carry over from the dream state into the waking state. In fact, there is actually a scientific study that actually shows this. What they did was they had two groups of people, and they had them practice coin tossing from across the room. They tried throwing coins from across the room into a cup to see how many times it landed in the cup. And they measured how many times they did it that night. And then the two groups went to sleep. And one group was a group that was lucid dreamers. And they were instructed to practice the coin tossing in their lucid dreaming that night. And the other group just slept normally. They tested the two groups again in the morning, and the group that had been practicing the coin tossing in their lucid dreaming throughout the night performed significantly better. So there is some real evidence and plenty of anecdotes from the people that I've spoken to that you can really actually improve your performance with lucid dreaming if you practice skills in it. It can also be used to heal injuries from past traumas. You can explore the philosophical mysteries of reality. There's evidence that dreaming can help to increase psychic abilities, that telepathy is possible with it. You can get answers to important questions. You can travel anywhere you like. It's very easy to travel in a lucid dream by teleporting yourself. And this is how you do it. What you do is you close your eyes and hold out your arms and start spinning around like a whirling dervish.
In the dream.
In the dream state. And while you're doing this, imagine the dream environment that you would like to find yourself in. And more often than not, when you open up your eyes, you will then find yourself in that dream environment.
Can you get hurt in a lucid dream state? Physically hurt?
That's an interesting question because, you know, I actually have a section on that in my book. And initially, when I first thought about that question, I thought, no. I thought, of course, your body's completely safe in bed, and anything that actually happens in the dream doesn't have any consequences with physical reality.
Hold that thought right there, David. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with that question. If you can get hurt in a lucid dream. And welcome back, David J. Brown with us, his book, Dreaming Wide Awake. And David, we're talking about if you could get hurt in a lucid dream. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, there's no scientific evidence that anyone has ever been harmed or can be harmed in a lucid dream. There is some concern. Some psychologists have concerns that extreme nightmares can actually cause cardiovascular problems or heart attacks in people who are extremely vulnerable. There's a little bit of evidence for that, but not much.
Well, some people have died in their sleep, David, but we don't know what was the catalyst for that. But, you know, let's say they died of a heart attack in their sleep. You know, most medical practitioners would say, well, you know, they had a heart attack, they had clogged arteries, something happened. But
exactly. It's very, very hard to prove.
Yeah.
that someone died of a heart attack due to a nightmare. The best cases we have are people that are were survivors from prisoners of war and had recurrent nightmares and died in their early 30s. There are some examples that they draw from, but I'm not that convinced that it's that dangerous. And in fact, lucid dreaming can be used as a psychotherapeutic technique to help overcome nightmares and to actually work with them so people don't experience the fear in them. There is some concern that people who are mentally unstable shouldn't be experimenting with techniques that open up their sense of reality and make it bigger and wider and weirder than it already is, you know, just like shamanic voyages. And it's just something maybe that some people shouldn't be doing. But, you know, but in general, really, I don't know of anyone who's ever been hurt from a lucid dream. I don't know of any scientific evidence. And there is very strong scientific evidence that people who engage in regular lucid dreaming are healthier, that they're happier, and they actually even have a larger regions in certain areas of their brains. So it seems like for most people, it's actually a very healthy thing to be doing.
If someone, for example, though, in a lucid dream is climbing a mountain and then falls off it, could they really get hurt physically?
Oh, no. They couldn't really get hurt.
They're not going to wake up with a broken leg or anything like that.
I'm sorry?
They won't wake up with...
They couldn't wake up with a broken leg. At least I don't know of anything like that. I mean, certainly, you know, the mind has incredible power over the body. And, you know, I don't want to say for sure because, I mean, who knows what kind of strange things could happen. But there isn't any evidence that anyone has ever been harmed as a result of an activity that they did inside of a lucid dream.
All right, let's talk about some of the therapeutic values of lucid dreaming. What can you do?
Well, lucid dreaming, there haven't really been a lot of scientific studies in this area, but there's certainly plenty of anecdotes and case studies from people who have used lucid dreaming as a way to heal themselves from physical injuries or infections. This is really an area that's just really crying out for more research. There's a famous story that I document in my book about someone who had a very serious infection in their tonsils, and during the lucid dream went over to a mirror and imagined a glowing, healing light around the tonsil area, and focused on that for a few minutes in the lucid dream. And when they woke up, about 90% of the infection had been cleared up. So, and I personally experienced lucid dreaming as a way of helping to heal myself from childhood traumas. So I really think that this is an area that really, really should be explored more, but there hasn't been enough scientific research in it, unfortunately.
It is fascinating, though, how the mind interconnects and does some of these incredible things. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's almost mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing, especially the abilities that we don't even know that the mind has. Most people don't even know that they can lucid dream, that they can awaken. And once you personally experience this, you're like, wow, I never knew my brain could do this.
What about people who have the ability to enter someone else's dream state?
Well, like in the movie The Inception, I mean, shared dreaming. I mean, this is something that I think is possible. I do think that people can share dreams. There hasn't been any scientific research done on it, at least not anything that I know of. But I think it is possible for people to share dream content, for people to actually share dream narratives, and in very rare cases, to actually share lucid dreams. Case in point, my partner and I, we had tried for a year to share a lucid dream, and we had many occasions where we shared dream content, had dreams about the same thing. When I was a small child, I had a dream with my younger brother. When I was around 7 and he was 4, we both had a dream about being in a spaceship with our grandmother who had birthday cake in her hair. I mean, really odd kinds of things. We were going back and forth. And I mean, how else do you explain these things besides some type of shared dreaming or telepathy? And my partner and I, we had been, trying for a year, and we had all these experiences with sharing dream content. And then we had a couple of experiences where one of us would have a lucid dream, and we would try to find the other partner, and we would find them, but they would be, you know, very puppet-like or mechanical or lacking personality or like they were unconscious. And there's an idea in the lucid dreaming community that this is because, you know, the person that you're actually trying to interact with in their own dream isn't lucid. So when they're not lucid, and if there is some type of connection, then they're going to come across as being a personality-less puppet or a moldable mechanical robot of some sort. Remarkably, my partner and I did share something that we believed to be a shared lucid dream. The way it happened was like this.
You're still there? Well, we may have lost him. Simply gone. Donna, call him back. Let's get him. Find out what happened to him. Right in the middle of his lucid dream. Maybe we're dreaming and we woke up. Or something like that. You never know. But we'll get it back. We've got his cell phone as a backup, too. But weird. Extremely weird where he just disappeared. And I will make a note of that in case there's not some gremlin in my phone system like that. But, I have used my dream state to get a lot of things done, too, and accomplished. I really have. I mean, I have gotten jobs that way. I have bettered my grades in school and in college that way. All kinds of things have happened. So it works, and it works in a real great way. So let's bring him back. So, David, you're back with us. We woke up from a dream, huh?
I guess so.
You just disappeared. What happened?
I guess so. I was able to hear you. You couldn't hear me. So
okay,
anyway, we're back connected again.
Okay. Yep, very good. Glad you're with us. Okay, so let's get back into this as we're talking about the lucid dreaming, entering someone else's dream state. You did try that and experimented with that.
Yes, exactly. So what I was saying was my partner and I actually had an experience where we believed to be a shared lucid dream. What happened was I found myself in the lucid dream state one night and immediately set off to find my partner, Becca. And suddenly found myself in our bedroom where we normally sleep, and there she was asleep in her part of the bed. And I go over to her, and I wake her up and rouse her. I'm like, Becca, wake up. We're having a lucid dream right now. And she kind of groggily lifts her head up and says, no, we're not. And I said, no, check. You know, try breathing through your closed nostrils. That's one of the tests we use to see if you're actually in a lucid dream, because you can't do it in waking reality, but you can do it in a lucid dream. So she tried breathing through her closed nostrils, was able to do it. She goes, oh, my God, you're right. We're dreaming right now. And a few seconds after that, I woke up. And a couple minutes later, my partner woke up, and she recalled something very similar. What she recalled was she was in a lucid dream and then felt that she had actually woken up. She had what's called a false awakening in the lucid dream literature, and that means that you waken from a lucid dream and think that you've wakened into physical reality, but in fact you're actually still dreaming, and you're just dreaming that you woke up. So she had this, you know, woke up from the lucid dream, false awakening, thinking that she's awake now, and there I am saying, Becca, we're dreaming right now. And she goes to me, no, we're not. And I said, she recalls hearing me tell her, check your nose, try breathing through your nose right now and see if you can do it, which she did, and she's like, oh my God, you're right, we're having a lucid dream right now. So she recalled that same exact story, and that I think is the closest we've ever come to actually sharing a lucid dream.
David, I wanted to talk with you about out-of-body experiences and lucid dreams. They're different, but they're similar, aren't they?
They are. You know, it's very hard to tell the difference sometimes, actually, between a lucid dream and an out-of-body experience. People who have, you know, surveys show that people who have a lot of lucid dreams also tend to have out-of-body experiences. And both lucid dreaming and out-of-body experiences involve interacting with a model of the world that doesn't correspond with what our physical senses are experiencing. I personally have experienced this quite a bit. When I used to float a lot in an isolation tank when I was younger, And in those the tanks, I would go through states of like sleep paralysis. And in those states of sleep paralysis, I found that I had kind of like a ghostly body that I was able to move outside of my body and do tumble salts in the air and have out-of-body experiences with it. But, you know, the odd thing was that when I would, you know, leave the room from one of these out-of-body experiences, the room that I would find myself in wasn't in exact identical replica of the room that I knew I was really in. In other words, it would be the room, but there would be like, you know, an extra window or an extra door or something, you know, the furniture would be moved in a slightly different way. So there was something kind of odd about it. So, you know, this is why, you know, there's a lot of skeptics who think that out-of-body experiences are really just a form of lucid dreaming, really, that they're just really a dream or a mental model that's created where we utilize memory and imagination to create a model of the world that we interact with. Now, on the other side of the coin, there have been studies. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with Robert Monroe's work.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, and Charles Tart did a study, and Stanley Krippner. There's really, you know, in the near-death experience work, there's really interesting evidence that out-of-body experiences really can be, you know, some type of spirit leaving the body, soul leaving the body. And yet at the same time, there's also evidence that it's really like a type of lucid dream. It's very mysterious, and I'm not really sure what to make of it. So it's, you know, it's one of those big mysteries. But wow, this is one of those areas that really deserves more scientific study.
That is dramatic.
I'm really curious, George. You know, you experienced an out-of-body experience when you
were 11 years old.
Yeah. So when you experienced it, did you experience the environment as being slightly different than what you remember it as?
What happened? I stayed home from school. You know, I think I may have missed one day of school in all my school years. And that was the day. I was 11 years old. I had a fever. I didn't feel good. Mom, I don't feel good. And you know, she said, Georgie, stay home. So, you know, I was in bed. I was asleep. And I somehow woke up. I thought it was a dream. I was bouncing at the ceiling, looking down at my body. And within seconds, that jarring of seeing my body in bed hit me, and I woke up really fast in my body again. And I went, wow, what was that? Was that a dream? But, you know, then I went on my quest, and I found out it was astral projection. I was floating above my body. I was awake. I was very coherent about the environment. Did not feel like a dream at all, but I was never able to duplicate it. And unfortunately, I didn't stay in that condition too long to be able to move around and, you know, go off into the never-never land.
Yes, it's so fascinating. Now, I wondered, you know, if when you were in that state, if you, when you looked around the room, if it looked identical or if there was something slightly different about it.
For what I could remember, I looked down, I saw my body in the bed. It felt like I was 15 feet above my body. But obviously, I wasn't. The room wasn't that tall, and I could just see myself in the entire bed from above. So it wasn't like I just saw a portion of it. I mean, I was really much higher than the room was.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I was outside of the room or what. I thought it was bouncing against the ceiling, but I could have been, you know, above the roof for all I know.
Yeah. Fascinating.
It was weird.
Yeah.
So
really, really interesting. Yeah, I really wonder about that. I wonder if there's a real reality to that or not. I think about it every day.
This condition of lucid dreaming, and again, practice makes perfect. How come it, for those people who don't experiment with it, why does it pop in sometimes and sometimes it doesn't?
You know, I really don't know the answer to that question. I don't know that anyone knows the answer why some people have spontaneous lucid dreams and some people don't. But this much I do know is that lucid dreaming is a learnable skill, and anyone can learn to have lucid dreams if they want to. I'll bet that a good portion of your listening audience tonight is going to have a lucid dream just from by virtue of, you know, hearing this program and thinking about it and, you know, talking to people about it. That in itself spontaneously produces lucid dreams in a lot of people. Another thing that one might want to do to get into the habit of having more lucid dreams is by regularly questioning your sense of reality. Get into the habit of asking yourself the question, am I dreaming right now? and actually testing your reality to actually see if you're dreaming or not by looking at a piece of paper, looking at, memorizing what the written words on it say, looking away and coming back and seeing if the words are the same. In a dream, they'll almost always change. As I mentioned earlier, try breathing through your nostrils with your nose pinched. You'll be able to do that easily in a dream. So testing your reality, asking yourself several times a day, am I dreaming right now? And then actually testing it. You know, get into the habit of taking those tests, because if you just flippantly say, oh, of course I'm not dreaming right now, you're going to carry that same habit over into the dream and just say, oh, of course I'm not dreaming, when you ask yourself that question in the dream without testing your reality. But if you get into the habit of testing your reality, then you'll find one of these days, if you get into the habit of doing it, you know, you have around, you're sleeping around 1/10 of the day in your dream. You're dreaming around 1/10 of the day. You've got a 1 in 10 chance of being right if you ask yourself that question regularly.
In the dream state, do you find that there's a common denominator with the dreaming, telepathy, and other things like that?
Common denominator with dreaming, telepathy. I'm not sure if there's a common denominator, but I'm well aware that there's been some fascinating scientific research into dream telepathy. You know, back in the 1960s and 1970s, Stanley Krippner did some fascinating research where he had a he did a study where he had people sleeping in a dream laboratory, and he had another group of people who would try to send them images while they were sleeping. People would go to sleep in a completely light and soundproof room where they couldn't get any sensory stimulation from outside the room, and someone outside the room would open up an envelope that had one of four different paintings in it, and the person who was considered to be the sender was supposed to try to visualize that artwork and send it to the person who was sleeping. They did this for several minutes, and then the person was woken up and was supposed to report whatever they were dreaming about. And then the following morning, an independent series of judges tried to match the dream reports with the paintings that were picked, or with one of the different four, randomly chosen paintings, and they had about a 25% chance of getting that right just by chance, and they performed much better than that. I think it was about 50%, jeez, I can't remember, much better, but significantly better than chance, and the odds against that were like billions to one. So it was very, very strong evidence that people can receive telepathic information in their dreams.
Okay, we're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM and take your phone calls as we talk about lucid dreaming, David J. Brown's book, Dreaming Wide Awake.